Thank you for that very warm welcome. Good to be here at the Fiji College of Evangelism. I've been most of the last month around this island and I've had a wonderful time. I started off here in Lautoka. I've been over the other side. I've been up the north. I got caught in floods. I didn't think I was going to get back here at one stage, but here I am. Tomorrow I'm off back to Australia. So I'm grateful that I did get back in time to fulfill this obligation to address you today. Thank you for the slot that you've given. I'm going to take a survey of a couple of the tribes of Israel, do something that's a little bit different from some of your ordinary studies, but that I hope will in some way interact with the studies that you're doing through the Bible. I want to look at the Joseph tribes of Israel. I'm going to start in Joshua chapter 17. Joseph had two tribes. Jacob had 12 sons, and the way the system worked was that the eldest, this is in the Israelite system, whether you like it or not, the eldest got a double portion of the inheritance. So Reuben should have got two tribal portions, and the others one each. But Reuben forfeited his right to the firstborn's inheritance because of his adultery with his stepmother, and the privilege passed to the tribe of Joseph. So Joseph got the two portions through his two sons, twin sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. You may remember that when Israel came up from Mount Sinai under the leadership of Moses with the aim of taking possession of Canaan, they came up on the eastern side of the Dead Sea and the eastern side of the Jordan River, and then they attacked across the Jordan and took Canaan proper. Now, if you have a look at this map here, you'll see what I'm talking about. And may I say, if you don't yet have the habit of looking at a map when you're reading the Bible, then please start to develop that habit. It's going to make so much difference to your understanding. And I think you'll see that illustrated today. If we don't understand where the tribes are located in the stories we're going to look at, then really the significance of the stories is lost. Many of the details in the stories will have no significance at all. So if you look here, you see they came up from Mount Sinai, they came up here on the eastern side, they conquered all that territory on the eastern side of the river, and then they went across and conquered Canaan. Canaan proper is the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean coast. The whole of this territory was then divided into tribes. 2.5 tribes gained their inheritance east of the river, 9.5 tribes west of the river. The 2.5 tribes to the east were Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. The other half of Manasseh, along with the remaining tribes, occupied the area of Canaan proper. You'll see here that I'm speaking now of the other half of Manasseh and the full tribe of Ephraim, which are in this area of Canaan proper. You'll notice that they are almost right in the center. They have a few smaller tribes to the north, and they have the large tribe of Judah to the south. But they really have some of the best territory in the country. Where we're reading here in Joshua 17, where we're going to start, concerns how Joshua divided the land. And so as you read through these chapters, you get lots of references to places and to boundaries. If you look at a map, you can sort out where the different tribes lived. Now the territory of Manasseh, I'm going to start from chapter 17, verse 7. The territory of Manasseh reached, well, I'm not going to go through all those details, all the different names of the towns and the villages, but if you come down to verse 10, it says the land to the south belonged to Ephraim, and that to the north belonged to Manasseh. So if you look at my map here, you'll find that the map is drawn correctly, more or less. It goes on to say that the sea formed the boundary, that's the Mediterranean Sea, the boundary on the west. In the north is Asher, and on the east Issachar. These are the neighboring tribes, Issachar and Asher. If you had have gone back earlier in the book, Joshua said something like this, or rather the Lord said to Joshua, "There remains yet very much land to be possessed." Although the people had conquered the entire land and it was now being divided up, there remained yet very much to be possessed. The explanation of that is that although Israel had taken possession of this entire territory that we have coloured here, within that territory there were pockets of Canaanite resistance. Mainly the Canaanites occupied the lowland areas, the valleys. The Israelites occupied the hills. That's a simple piece of information to carry with you. It'll help you in your reading of the Bible no end. That the Israelites were basically a mountain people. They had difficulty controlling the valleys and the plains because the Philistines were there and they had chariots, which of course only operate in flat areas. They don't operate chariots in mountains and in forested areas of the hills, but it enabled the Philistines to resist the Israelite invasion. So now that the land has been occupied in general and it's being divided up among the tribes, each tribe now has its own responsibility to move down into those lowland areas and to clean out those last remaining bits and pieces of the Canaanite peoples. Manasseh was a powerful tribe. The tribes of Joseph were powerful, Manasseh and Ephraim. The neighboring tribes to the north, Issachar and Asher, and of course the others, Zebulun, Naphtali and so on, they are smaller. It seems from reading the story that Manasseh had said, "We will help you drive out the Canaanites from these villages just across our border." I'm sorry to tell you that really what has happened is that the Manasseh people have gone across, apparently to help those smaller tribes drive out the Canaanites, but they have not succeeded. However, the Manasseh people did not then retreat. They simply kept the villages for themselves. So really it was a very sneaky way of expanding their border, using their muscle, using their power, using their seniority to force themselves and to get a bit more territory for themselves. They were greedy. They already had a very generous allocation. Look at this map. They have a big area that's been allocated to them. They're still not satisfied. That's a good reflection on human nature. That's what it means in verse 11. That also in Issachar and Asher, Manasseh had Beth Shean and its villages, Ibleam and its villages, Dor, Endor, Taanach, Megiddo, and so on, all the villages round about these towns. But, verse 12, the sons of Manasseh could not take possession of those cities because the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in that land. So Manasseh was not successful in driving out, but neither did it hand back the villages. And so those villages remained within the Manasseh borders. Selfishness. People using their position of power to exploit those who are weaker. Come down to verse 14 through to the end of the chapter. It mentions here the tribe of Joseph. Now the tribe of Joseph, as I've just said, is in fact two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. As you read through this part, it mainly concerns Ephraim, though it also concerns Manasseh. And they're complaining. When you go through the story, you're going to find that they are always complaining. In Australia, we call them whingers. A whinger is a person that's always got a complaint about something. The tribes of Joseph, especially Ephraim, always seem to have a complaint. They are never satisfied. Manasseh is not satisfied with the generous allotment of territory it already has. It wants some extra. Now we're going to find that Ephraim is not satisfied, and Manasseh is included in this story as well. What they're saying is, we are a large tribe, we have a lot of people, we want more territory, we want more area in the hills, and the trouble is it is forested. And Joshua's reply is, well, okay, if it's covered with trees, then you go and chop them down. Don't simply sit there and say, give us more territory, because the territory we've got has too many trees on it, and we don't have enough room to live. Chop the trees down, and make yourself villages and fields and farms. And as for the chariots of the Philistines that control the valleys, if you want to control the valleys, you've got to get rid of those chariots. You've got to go down there and do a bit of fighting. And it's interesting to see that Joshua, who is saying these things, is himself from the tribe of Ephraim. I like that little sidelight because it shows he is not biased. He doesn't show favoritism to his own tribe, which of course is what happens, as you know, in most countries of the world, whether it's a tribal group or an ethnic group, a political group, a denominational group within the church, people show favoritism. But Joshua is very even-handed, and he's very straightforward the way he addresses these people. The tribe of Joseph, in verse 14, said to Joshua, "Why have you given me only one lot and one portion as an inheritance when I am a numerous people?" Actually, they had two portions. They had Ephraim and Manasseh. But it seems that Ephraim was the one that was leading this particular complaint. Verse 15, Joshua said, well, if you are a numerous people, you see, they said in verse 14, we're a numerous people. And so in verse 15, Joshua said, well, if you are a numerous people, all the more reason why you can go and do some work. you've got plenty of manpower. So use your numerous people to go and chop down some trees. Go up to the forest and clear the ground for yourselves in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaim. Since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you, expand it by simply clearing the areas already given to you. The tribe of Joseph said also, the hill country is not enough for us, and the Canaanites who dwell in the plain, they have chariots of iron, both those in Beth Shean and in the valley of Jezreel. So Joshua says, there's too much forest on the hills, but you don't want to work for it. There are too many chariots in the valleys, but you don't want to fight for them. You want everything just to be given to you. Well, he says you can have more areas in the hills to build your villages, but you've got to go and work and cut down the trees. And you can have more area for your villages in the valleys also, but you've got to go down there and fight for it and get rid of the opposition. Good example for Christians who always want things dished up on a plate, nice and easy for them. So in verse 16 they say, the hill country's not enough, and the Canaanites who dwell in the valleys, they've got chariots of iron. So Joshua says in verse 17, he says to Ephraim and Manasseh, you are a numerous people, you have great power, you shall not have one lot only. The hill country shall be yours, even though it's a forest, but you shall clear it and possess it to its farthest borders. And you shall drive out the Canaanites from the valleys, even though they've got chariots of iron and even though they're strong. So Joshua sends them packing. He sends them off, letting them know that if they want extra, then they have to fight for it, they have to work for it. Go across now to Judges chapter 7. This is the story of Gideon. Actually, we should start in chapter 6. I'm not going to go through the whole story of Gideon because you are familiar with it, how Gideon was fighting the Midianites back in chapter 6, verse 33. The Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east, they came together. They crossed the Jordan. Now look at the map. They came from the east and they crossed the Jordan. So they're now in the west, in the territory of Ephraim and Manasseh. Gideon, incidentally, is from the tribe of Manasseh. One of the things you notice when you're reading the book of Judges, that the judge that God raises up in each case comes from the tribe, from the tribal area where the enemy invasion is taking place. Another one of those things where you need to look at the map each time so you can see exactly what's happening. So they've attacked Ephraim and Manasseh, and God has raised up this man from Manasseh. He's from the clan of Abiezer, which is one of the clans within the tribe of Manasseh. Coming back to verse 33, the Midianites have come from the east, they've crossed the Jordan, and they're now in the valley of Jezreel, which we know from what we read before is one of those areas that the Manasseh people took from their neighbouring tribe, and now they've called it their own. But the Spirit of the Lord in 34 took possession of Gideon. He sounded the trumpet, and the people of Abiezer were called out. So Gideon's own townspeople were the first ones who came to join him in response to his appeal to drive back the aggressors. Verse 35, he sent messages throughout the remainder of Manasseh, his own tribal region, and they too were called out to follow him. He also sent messages into the neighboring tribes of Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, which shows that these raids from the Midianites had apparently extended quite a bit further on. What Gideon is doing is assembling a large army. Now the bit of the story that we know best is that God said, I'm not going to use the whole of that army to launch the surprise attack against the Midianites. I only need 300. And those 300 were the ones who blew the trumpets in the middle of the night, smashed the clay pots, made a great noise, and really gave the Midianites such a fright that they all awoke in the middle of the night thinking there was a great attack going on. Seeing hundreds of lights and hearing hundreds of trumpet blasts and seeing hundreds of people flashing swords, actually it was only 300, but they just took flight. And when they took flight, then coming down now to chapter 7 verse 23, when they took flight, Gideon then called out the remainder of his army, this army that he had assembled from Manasseh and the neighboring tribes. And the remainder of the army now pursued the Midianites. Verse 23, the men of Israel were now called out from Naphtali and Asher and Manasseh, the ones we just read about, and they now pursued after Midian. Gideon then sent in verse 24 a message to the hill country of Ephraim. Notice that Ephraim is to the south of Manasseh. So it seems to me that the Midianites were largely attacking up around Manasseh and those northern tribes to the east of the Sea of Galilee. Ephraim, which is south of Manasseh, may have been attacked also, but because they're a brother tribe, Gideon decides to call them out to help him in the battle. And what he asks them to do is to go down here to the Jordan River and to seize the fords. The Jordan could only be crossed at certain points. It was only a small river, but it had steep banks and thick jungle growing around it, so that it was difficult to cross. But there were natural crossings at three or four places, and you can usually identify these places as you read the story. What Ephraim does is go down to seize those fords of Jordan to stop the Midianites fleeing back. Now the Midianites are now going to flee back from the west across the Jordan and go back east where they came from. So that's what we're reading in verse 24. Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, and he said, notice the hill country again. Hill country all the time. It's the hill country that the Israelites occupied. Come down against the Midianites and seize the waters against them as far as Beth Barah and also the Jordan. So all the men of Ephraim were called out. They seized the waters as far as Beth Barah and all the Jordan, and they took the two princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, and they killed them both. But then they complained. So here we're going to see it again, this constant complaint of the people of Ephraim, chapter 8, verse 1. They came to Gideon and they said, "What is this that you have done to us? Why did you not call us when you went to fight with Midian? Why were we not called to the main battle?" And so they scolded him violently, it says. This was a real stand-up, aggressive argument. And they were offended because they had not been invited to the main battle, and they were simply told to go down and seize the fords to stop the escape of the enemy. And by that time, a lot of the enemy had actually escaped. But at least they managed to capture and kill the two princes of the Midianites. Now Gideon is a very cool customer. He's very calm and collected. And he's an example here of the proverb that says, a soft answer can turn away wrath. Now sometimes people say something to us and we respond very violently with a bad temper, and we shout at them. But Gideon kept his cool, and he says to them something like this. Oh, he said, look, what you fellows have done is greater than anything I have done. You've captured the princes. All I've done is defeated the foot soldiers, the privates and the lance corporals and all these ordinary people. He gave an illustration. The illustration was this. When you harvest the grapes, you have the main harvest. And then after the main harvest, you go back a second time and you get the gleanings. And the gleanings are the ones and the twos here and there that are hidden under the leaves that you didn't get the first time. He says, I had a great vintage, a great harvest of grapes in killing so many of the Midianites. But you fellows had the gleanings. But look at the gleanings. The gleanings are the two generals in the army, the leaders of the army. So my vintage of ordinary foot soldiers cannot compare with your gleanings of the two leaders. And they were persuaded. They liked that. They started to feel good after Gideon had given them a pat on the back. That's my explanation of verses 2 to 3. He said, Gideon said, what have I done in comparison with you? You are the greatest. Is not the gleanings of the grapes of Ephraim, talking to the Ephraim people, and you've got the gleanings, is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? Abiezer was Gideon's home village. I have had a great vintage, but only rank and file soldiers. You have captured the princes. Verse 3. God has given into your hands the princes of the Midian people, Oreb and Zeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you? And when they heard that, their anger against him was abated. Mind you, that was at the end of Gideon. He'd calmed these people down. He then crossed the river and went in hot pursuit of other Midianite leaders. But that's another story. Now let's go across to chapter 12. This is a later story, and this one concerns the other side of the river. On this occasion, the attack has come from the Ammonites. If you go to the end of chapter 10, verse 17, the Ammonites were called to arms and they encamped in Gilead. Gilead is a general name for the eastern territories, especially those of Gad and up here into Manasseh, half of Manasseh on the eastern side of the Jordan, often referred to as Gilead. The Ammonites had come and attacked. Why had they attacked? Well, very briefly, when Joshua and Moses and the hordes of Israel came from Mount Sinai and moved up this side of the river, they took possession of all this eastern territory. But the people they dispossessed were the Amorites, A-M-O-R, Amorites. The Amorites had taken possession earlier from the Ammonites, who used to be in the north, and the Moabites in the south. But Israel did not take any territory from the Ammonites or the Moabites because they were relatives of the people of Israel. They were descended from Lot, who of course was a relation of Abraham, so they're distant cousins of the Israelites. The Israelites did not possess the Ammonites and the Moabites. They dispossessed the Amorites, who had now occupied that territory for quite a long time. The Ammonite and Moabite rulers during the period of Moses and Joshua did not make any complaint against the Israelites for what they had done. But now we are a long time later in the story. Israel has been up and down with strength and weakness, and God has raised up various judges to deliver the people in different parts of the country. Now on this occasion, the Ammonites, in verse 17, have been called to arms, and they have come and camped in Gilead. And the people of Israel came together and they camped at Mizpah. The leaders of Gilead, that is the leaders on the eastern side of the river, they said to one another, "Who is the man who will begin to fight against the Ammonites? Who's going to be our leader? We'll make him the head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." Well, the man they found was Jephthah the Gileadite in the next verse, chapter 11, verse 1, Jephthah the Gileadite. But Jephthah was not brought up in a godly home. He was the son of a harlot, son of a prostitute, and his brothers and sisters threw him out in verse 2. The result was, in verse 3, that Jephthah fled into the wilderness regions. He grew up with a bunch of bandits, worthless fellows they collected around Jephthah, and he went raiding with them. So he became the leader of a group of bandits, a gang of bandits, and he was a tough man. He had very little understanding of God, but when the people of Gilead went to call him to be their leader, he at least had enough faith in God to respond. You might say he is a very new, but very fresh, a very green, a very immature believer. But he had enough faith to respond, and for that reason, of course, he's mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 as a man who believed God and acted. But his understanding of God was very much coloured by his former pagan practices. That's why he vowed his daughter if God gave him the victory. But we're not going to digress onto that. I just want to speak about this eastern territory of the people of Gilead, the people of Manasseh, and the Ammonites who attacked them. So go down to verse 12, if you will. Jephthah sent messages to the king of the Ammonites, and he said, "Why have you come against me? Why have you come to fight against me and my land?" And the king of the Ammonites said in verse 13, "Because when Israel came out of the land of Egypt, they dispossessed us, and they took possession of our land, and now we're coming and we're going to take it back." Jephthah says, "No, you're not." And he gives his reasons. He says in verse 15, "Israel did not take away the land of the Ammonites or the land of Moab." He goes through and describes it all. He says, "The land that we took was the land of the Amorites," verse 19. Verse 22, it says the same. "We took the land from the Amorites." Verse 23, "God dispossessed the Amorites." So what are you doing coming now to create an argument? The king of Moab didn't complain. The king of Ammon didn't complain when those events took place in the time of Moses and Joshua. Why are you coming now and creating this problem? Get lost, push off, go home. We're not going to listen to you. Well, the Ammonites didn't take any notice. As a result, Jephthah attacked them and he won a great victory. Now, once again, the people of Ephraim have a complaint. Come to chapter 12. The people of Ephraim, of course, were from the west, and they had now come down and crossed the river. Get your map straight again here. Look at the map. They came from Ephraim on the west. They crossed the river. they came across into Gilead, which is on the east, and they confronted Jephthah. And they said to Jephthah in chapter 12, verse 1, "Why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites, and you did not call us to go with you?" They are offended again. These people are easily offended. They were offended because Gideon only called them to do a fairly minor job of seizing the river crossing. These people are offended again. This is probably another generation, maybe a different group of people, but it's a characteristic of the tribe of Ephraim. They are easily offended. And some Christians are like that too. We have to work very hard at not being easily offended. Ephraim and Manasseh, who had some of the best territory and some of the best blessings of God in the division of the land, they're never satisfied. And so they came and they talked to Jephthah like this: "Why did you not call us to fight against the Ammonites? We're going to burn your house with fire." Ooh, you don't speak like that to Jephthah. You might speak like that to Gideon and get away with it, because Gideon has a soft answer that turns away wrath. But Jephthah doesn't have a soft answer that turns away wrath. He was a bandit leader. He was a gang leader. He's a tough character. And he says, "Look, you guys," verse 2, "I and my people had a great fight with the Ammonites, and I did in fact call you to come and help me, but you didn't respond. You all sat at home playing football, watching the TV. And when I saw," verse 3, "that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hand, and I crossed over against the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you now come up to me this day to fight against me? Get lost, go home." And Jephthah, in verse 4, gathered all the men of Gilead, and he fought with Ephraim. And the reason he fought with Ephraim was that the Ephraim people did not have enough brains to keep their mouth closed. When somebody like Jephthah talks to you like that, the safe thing to do would be to turn around and go home. But these people, they think they're better than everybody else. They are a proud people, the people of Ephraim. And they said, "Oh, the trouble with you people east of the river, you're fugitives. You've run away from the rest of us of Israel. You're second class. We're the proper Israelites who live in Canaan, the promised land. But you're living in dirty territory, in foreign territory, across the river. You're fugitives in the midst of Ephraim and Manasseh. Half the tribe coming to live over on this side of the river." And so that was the accusation they made in verse 4. And when Jephthah heard that, he launched an attack. And very quickly, you find who the fugitives are, who's running away. It's not the people of Gilead who are running away, it's the people of Ephraim who are running away. They find that they have got more than they bargained for. And very quickly, the men of Jephthah attack them. And so the Ephraimites are now the fugitives. They're running back, and they try to get down and get across the Jordan River. But they're not able to, because the men of Gilead came and they seized the fords of Jordan against the people of Ephraim. Isn't there a nice twist in that story? Isn't it amazing how often what we sow we reap? How God brings things back to remind us of something. They complained before that all they had been asked to do by Gideon was to seize the fords. Now they wish that the fords were not there. They wish that somebody else hasn't seized the fords, because now they can't get across. And so their complaint has turned a somersault. It's turned on its head. And where once before they were complaining that that was all they were asked to do, now they were wishing that nobody was there to do it against them. Yes, God has a way of letting us know that the evil that we do, the wrong that we do, in some way eventually comes back to haunt us. What we sow, we reap. Our deeds return upon our own head, one way or another. And you can read the rest of the story there, how they didn't escape, but were slaughtered there at the fords of Jordan. We just go across to 1 Kings. That's a couple of references there. When the nation split in two, the nation of Israel split in two after the reign of Solomon, the man who led the rebellion was from Ephraim. One of the things that you must keep in mind as you're reading the Bible, and you'll notice it if you keep your eyes open as you're reading the Old Testament, there was constant jealousy and competition between the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Judah. Ephraim and Manasseh were from Joseph. Judah, of course, was the other powerful tribe. And between those Joseph tribes and the Judah tribe, they had nearly all the power and influence in Israel. But of course, Ephraim and Manasseh are in the north, Judah is in the south. There's often conflict and tension between the north and south, and so it was here. Solomon had a big building program where he made people work virtually as slaves, not exactly slaves, but certainly it was forced labor. And in chapter 11, verse 26, it says that Jeroboam, who was a man from Ephraim, you notice he's from Ephraim, he lifted up his hand against the king. He plotted against Solomon. He resented this imposition of the power of Solomon, who was from the tribe of Judah and in the south. He resented this imposition of their power upon the people of the north. Verse 28, Jeroboam was very able. And when Solomon saw that he was very able and industrious, he put him in charge over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. Jeroboam had a very influential position. He was in charge of the two Joseph tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. And he used that position for himself to get into a position of power. Solomon found out about it and tried to kill him. The result was in verse 40 that Jeroboam fled to Egypt for safety. But after he was in Egypt for some time, meanwhile back in Jerusalem, back in Israel, Solomon died and he was succeeded by his son Rehoboam. And when Rehoboam became king, the first thing he did was to go to Shechem. Now Shechem is right on the boundary between Ephraim and Manasseh. It is right in the middle of the northern territory and right in the middle of the two northern tribes. Rehoboam realized that he was losing control of the north, and so he went to Shechem to establish his kingdom. But as soon as Solomon had died, this is in chapter 12, verse 1, I just read about Rehoboam going to Shechem, and in verse 2, as soon as Jeroboam heard that Solomon was dead, he returned to Israel. And he, of course, led the rebellion. And so the northern tribes broke away from the southern tribes. Ephraim became the leading tribe in the north, and Judah, of course, was the leading tribe in the south. And when Jeroboam broke away, just to rub salt into the wound, as we would say, just to make things worse for Rehoboam, Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, had to retreat to Jerusalem and realize that he had lost the kingdom. All he had now was Jerusalem and Judah and a few bits and pieces, Benjamin and Simeon in the south, which had already been absorbed into Judah. That was all the kingdom he had. The remaining tribes all to the north and across the river to the east, all of that became the northern kingdom. It still called itself Israel. The southern kingdom now called itself Judah, even though it was the proper continuation of the Davidic kingdom. The southern kingdom was the proper continuation of the Davidic rule, with Jerusalem still as the capital and the temple still in Jerusalem in the south. So they called themselves Judah, but the breakaway group to the north, which was the majority of the country, it continued to call itself Israel. And Jeroboam, as I said, to rub salt into the wound in verse 25, he goes to Shechem, the very place where Rehoboam had gone to try to establish his kingdom, but had been forced to retreat. Jeroboam now goes to Shechem, and notice it's in the hill country of Ephraim, right near the border with Manasseh, and that was his first center of administration. He made another center of administration on the other side of the river at Penuel to hold the allegiance of the eastern tribes. If you read a bit further, you will see that he shifted his capital from Shechem to Tirzah, which was not very far away, and a subsequent king shifted it again from Tirzah to Samaria. And for most of the rest of the history of the northern kingdom, Samaria was the capital city. Now, there's not a lot about the individual tribes through the rest of the Old Testament, because after you get out of the period of the judges, the individual tribes are no longer all running their own show, their own business. We come into the books of Samuel and Kings, where a kingdom is established and it's all under the rule of a central king. But now, of course, the kingdom's been divided into north and south, and the first king of the north is a man from Ephraim, and of course the king of the south continues always to be a king from Judah. So we come to the end of the story now in the book of Hosea. Can you go across, please, to Hosea chapter 13. One thing you must remember in reading Hosea is that often he uses the word Ephraim as a synonym for the whole of the northern kingdom Israel. Because Ephraim was the dominant tribe, sometimes Israel is referred to as Ephraim. Sometimes the reference is to the tribe that asserted itself as the leader, other times it is to the whole of that northern kingdom. I've got my Bible open here at two pages. At the end of chapter 11, Ephraim has encompassed me. Chapter 12, verse 1, Ephraim herds the wind. Verse 8, Ephraim has said. Verse 14, Ephraim has given bitter proclamation. Chapter 13, verse 1, Ephraim spoke. Verse 12, the iniquity of Ephraim. And so Ephraim is mentioned here. I just want to look at these couple of verses right at the very beginning of chapter 13. In fact, we'll only look at verse 1. Our time is just about gone. When Ephraim spoke, men trembled, and he was exalted in Israel. Ephraim was the leading tribe. When Ephraim spoke, the other tribes sat up and took notice. And Ephraim was exalted in Israel because it became the leading tribe of the northern kingdom. But Ephraim incurred guilt through Baal, and he died. And that's the solemn note that I'm going to leave this study on. Ephraim prided itself in being the leading tribe. And you and I sometimes, we want the leading position. We want to be pastors, we want to be elders, we want to be reverends, we want to be evangelists, we want to be Christian workers, we want to be directors of this ministry or that. Well, that may be okay, because there must be leaders of one sort or another, and we have to accept responsibilities of leadership, no doubt. But it carries responsibility, not only for the good things, but for the bad. Ephraim prided itself that it was the leading tribe. Therefore, Ephraim must accept responsibility for the subsequent idolatry and corruption of Israel and its ultimate death. We cannot simply have the good things to suit our own ego, our own pride. We have to accept the responsibility that goes with it. And if there is failure, then those who carry that responsibility have to accept their part in that failure. We all want to be around when people are cheering and shouting and clapping hands and saying how great it all is. But when everything goes wrong, then if we're at the top, we have to accept responsibility for that also. And so that's a very solemn note to finish on. But it's not surprising, because people who are easily offended, people who always want to be at the top, people who are ambitious, like the tribe of Ephraim, always wanting to be in the forefront, always wanting their way, always wanting things to be done the way they want them to be done, always complaining if somebody else gets ahead of them, they eventually make it to the top. They are the leaders in Israel. When men spoke, they trembled. They were exalted. But they are also held responsible for leading the nation into idolatry, into Baalism, and for the nation's ultimate collapse, destruction, and captivity in a foreign land. So there we have it, the tribes of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, and I trust that we might learn some lessons from them.